So we made it to the other side of Halloween. How is the weather there in the parts unknown, Utah?
Actually, it's super nice.
Oh, go to hell.
Sorry.
We've had like three significant snows. It's not fun.
Yeah, nothing here. It's little rain. Mostly short sleeve weather.
Aren't you known much for your snow? Like, it couldn't be that the climate is changing somehow, could it?
I'm not going to get into that. I'm not touching that one with a 10-foot pole. Nice try.
Yeah, you know, I hate to get political on the show. I really do. But we might.
Yeah, we try not to go there, but sometimes you just end up there. Okay, this is Binging the Purge. 3, 2, 1.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Nighthawks podcast, the cinema-centric podcast for you crazy cat and kittens who like to stay up late. We are two film critics. We are people who watch a lot of movies and we talk about them and tell you how we feel about them and opine a little bit. I'm Trevor T. Trujillo, and with me in the conceptual Nighthawks diner, as always, is my co-host.
I'm Matt Foster.
How are you doing tonight, Matt?
I don't know. It's late and it's quiet and I like it that way.
Well, Matt, there's certainly a lot going on. We're coming right out of Monstoberfest, so we thought we would give the people a break. And we'd give them some nice non-horror, light fare, some feel-good movies. And then we threw that idea right out the window and said, you know what? The holidays have begun. And the next upcoming holiday we have is Election Day.
Election Day is not a national holiday, of course. And you don't get the day off for it, and it's not on a weekend. But, you know, that possibly can't matter at all.
So we would like to take this time on the Nighthawks podcast to... if you are eligible, we would encourage you to get out and vote. I don't think there's many people you can talk to in the world right now, regardless of their politics, who are entirely happy with the way things are going right now, whatever that means to you. And the only way to change that right now is to get out there and vote. So regardless of how your politics may swing, we here at the Nighthawks are... very much encouraging all of our friends and listeners out there to get that little sticker.
Little sticker?
Yeah, the little I voted sticker.
Oh, well, you know, you don't have to get one of those because you can vote early by mail.
That's true. I think by the time this comes out, though, that window will have closed.
Truth. Fair enough.
In observation of Election Day, we decided we weren't going to fully step out of genre film. We're going to give you something... I don't know that you'd call this a horror franchise, Matt, would you? Like, it's definitely a home invasion when we kick off that first movie, but I think we've really come beyond that.
It's something, but I don't know if it's quite horror. It's a little too exploitative to just call it an action thriller.
Well, and we've got a couple of hot takes on this, but folks, we are talking about the Purge franchise, and specifically for this episode... we are going to be talking about 2016's The Purge Election Year. This is the third film in the franchise. We try and work around those spoiler warnings, but there is going to be no formal spoiler curtain in this episode. We're going to be talking about this particular movie, probably in toto. And to do that, we're probably going to be spoiling elements, if not major elements, of the other two films in the franchise. Well, I guess there's actually three at this point, although I am not fully familiar with my Purge lore. But the point being, folks, is that if this is something that you're wanting to hit cold, You're going to want to do it before you listen to the episode. The major takeaway, though, before you turn us off, though, is get out and vote.
For the candidate of your choosing, not necessarily mine. You don't have to do what I would like.
Matt, before we get into the meat and potatoes of the Purge election year, what have you been watching anything else recently?
I burned through The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina.
I caught a couple episodes of that. I'm really liking it.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. A little bit of a darker, grittier, more orgies than the Melissa Joan Hart incarnation.
Well, the showrunner on this, the guy kind of the brains behind it all, is the guy who penned the Chilling Adventures of Sabrina comic book, which was kind of a darker, grittier reboot of the Archie franchise. And we've talked about this. I don't know how much of these conversations have actually made it onto the show, but we talk a little bit about Archie as the blank canvas. You know, Archie is so, at this point, ingrained in the American lexicon that it really just has infinite remix value. And we've seen a lot of that. We've seen a lot of Archie comics where Archie crosses over with the Ninja Turtles, or he crossed over with the Punisher at one point. Yes, I'm not making that up. I distinctly remember a Kiss, the rock band, covering crossing over with Archie. And really, that's kind of their modus operandi in the modern sphere. Like, we're no longer really that interested in telling another story about an affluent white kid in a love triangle. But what we can do is we can take that as a known trope and spin it. And of course, Sabrina was a peripheral character to Archie and Betty and the gang. But it's definitely a newer, fresher take on something that we've kind of grown comfortable with. And I got to give credit to the Melissa Joan Hart version. I was not a big fan myself, but it certainly kept that character alive for modern audiences.
Well, yeah, and this is very much a companion piece to Riverdale, the sort of updated Archie.
Which I admit I have not caught, but it, like, totally in my wheelhouse.
Well, and then what we have here is actually kind of interesting because we have the character Sabrina Spellman. She's going to become a witch on her 16th birthday if she signs her name in the big black book of the beast. It's kind of strange because her family is very witchy. It's expected of her, and there's a strange subversion here. The family's history of witchcraft and of living by the code of the witch kind of stands in for other creeds which a teenager might defy. I mean, simultaneously, it's also used to be something that, like, the townspeople were oppressing. It's funny because what's coded as witchcraft jumps around here. It's actually rather clever. Ends up being pretty fun.
I do want to bring up that this particular incarnation of Sabrina is not without its own brand of controversy either. And I was a little worried. I was thinking that maybe there was going to be some satanic panic in this and some concerned parents. And, you know, you saw a lot of this coming out when Harry Potter was first kind of apexing as a popular property. But I actually find that the group that's kind of having a grievance with this is the Satanic Church. And it appears there is some question over some appropriated intellectual property or some accusations thereof regarding some of the imagery and statuary used in the film. And I've also heard from some folks who felt that the show misrepresents their beliefs. I can't speak to any of that. I don't have a dog in the fight myself. But it has been interesting to see that coming from a different voice.
The specific issues of, like, the specific pictures and statues they ripped off aside, what the Church of Satan doesn't like is the Church of Satan's very satirical, and it doesn't believe in a literal Satan. And they feel somewhat slighted that this is all about a supposedly literal Satan, right? I kind of feel like they freaked out before they watched the whole thing and heard how the bit ends, because it's very much church in Satan's clothing. The Satanism in the show really stands in for Midwestern morality, and leaving the church is kind of like Sabrina thinking for herself. So it's actually, it's a message very in keeping with their actual satire if they would have heard it out. I think they're only hurting themselves. But I don't know. The statue was pretty similar.
Yeah, I mean, I the case that's been made for that, you know, just in passing on my Facebook wall has been pretty compelling. And again, I don't have a dog in the fight, but it'll be interesting to see how that unfolds. Lately, to follow up on our last episode, what is now the final film of Orson Welles has been released to the masses on Netflix, and that's what I've been watching lately. We had his final film, The Other Side of the Wind, and a companion documentary also hit Netflix this week called They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, which is the story about this film, which up until a couple days ago was a lost film, was a film that had never been released. Being the Orson Welles fan that I am, and coming hot off the 80th anniversary of War of the Worlds, which we just covered, I found this very fitting, and I've been like a kid in a candy store, man. This has been a good week to be an Orson Welles fan.
Yeah, what did you think?
You know, it was different. It was really different, especially for something like him. It had kind of a kinetic pacing that was really similar if you've seen elements of F is for Fake. Real similar kind of a kinetic pacing, but it's very, very meta. It is a movie about an aging filmmaker and his protege and feelings of betrayal that Orson Welles famously felt. John Huston plays the aging filmmaker who is obviously a thinly veiled stand-in for Welles. Peter Bogdanovich plays essentially himself, and they're talking about this movie that they're filming, and there are elements that have been shot of this movie within the movie that fold in with the narrative of the film. But basically, the whole story is the last night of this filmmaker's life is his birthday party. And it is a birthday party where they have invited a lot of the avant-garde filmmakers of the time, and many real filmmakers make cameos in here. But they have also invited the film press. And so the entire movie, with the exception of the movie within the movie, all exists as a non-objective camera. And it's almost a found footage film. It's lots of different angles and shots taken from different cameras that exist within the narrative, put together to showcase this birthday party, the last night of this man's life. And so, again, it's Orson Welles. It's boldly experimental. It's wholly different. It's totally out of his lane. It contains a lot of nudity, which is a new thing for Welles. And the film within a film is not a typical Welles film. And the film that exists is not a typical Welles film. And so it's really interesting from that angle. And then to go and watch They'll Love Me When I'm Dead, which is the remembrances of several of the people, some of them through archival footage who are no longer with us, and some of those who they were able to get new interviews with, discussing the story, the 40-year tale of this phantom film, and their feelings about it, and realizing that they were playing incarnations of themselves, and that some of their personal grievances were being laid bare in this film, which is something that echoes back to what Citizen Kane was, which was a very thinly veiled indictment of William Randolph Hearst. And so in a weird way, this is the bookend where it's a thinly veiled indictment of Welles himself. And so I'm going to have to watch it another couple times. It's far from my favorite film of his, but it was definitely interesting and really exciting just to finally be able to see this movie. I've heard about it for years, and now they have finally gotten it out of the contested rights hell that it was in. And Peter Bogdanovich and Frank Marshall, and I think J.J. Abrams even did some fundraising for it, and finally got this movie finished. And the story behind the movie is equally fascinating. I would definitely recommend both of these films kind of in companion as you are planning out your streaming week.
Kind of the point for the consumer is this is fully finished and watchable. It's not something from the cutting room floor that only a completist need watch.
I mean, it's not Welles' most accessible film. You're going to have a few questions. You're going to be scratching your head. It is definitely... in one way, it is something to be picked apart and analyzed, and in another way, it almost indicts people for doing that. And so even that, it's just a very complex film. So it is definitely a film nerd's film. It's an art film. It's a capital A art film. But it's one that I think if it's something that interests you, it's definitely worth the watch. But yeah, it is a fully realized, fully complete film.
That's pretty sweet. I'm always glad to see some buried treasure surface. If somebody out there has that whole cut of Metropolis.
Lost Spider Pit sequence from King Kong. We'd like to see that.
Ooh, yeah. Spider Pit. It's a pit filled with spiders. Doesn't fit the song.
Well, speaking of pits and questionable things therein, let's get into the meat and potatoes of this episode's discussion. We're going to be talking about The Purge election year from 2016.
This is not a test. This is your emergency broadcast system announcing the commencement of the annual purge sanctioned by the U.S. government. Weapons of Class 4 and lower have been authorized for use during the purge. All other weapons are restricted. Government officials of ranking 10 have been granted immunity from the purge and shall not be harmed. Commencing at the siren, any and all crime, including murder, will be legal for 12 continuous hours. Police, fire, and emergency medical services will be unavailable until tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. when the purge concludes. Blessed be our new founding fathers and America, a nation reborn. May God be with you all.
Yes, the purge. Or as it's known in Spanish, Night of the Beasts. This is like a weird one because the first purge was kind of a B+. Like it had some name people in it, and it was a decent little, you know, if you went to it at a matinee, you probably weren't ticked off, but it's kind of a dumb idea, right? For people that don't know, the Purge franchise revolves around a political reality where one day a year crime is legal and everybody can go get it out of their system and then be good citizens the rest of the year. The Purge is kind of a home invasion special. It's just about one family trying to get through it. How they kind of barricade themselves up in their house and fight the zombies. I mean, the purgers outside, right? And here's the thing. Why I kind of rallied for the purge is, and honestly, is not one of Trevor's favorites. I browbeat him into it.
We'll get to that in a second. But yeah, I'll give you the conceit that when you pitched this episode, that's where I was at.
The specific reason that I was interested in the purge, like critically, is because it is a rare franchise that increases its quality and deepens its thesis as it goes on. So like when you hear the idea of the purge, it's like a nice little, you know, maybe good for a solid episode of Twilight Zone premise. Well, every subsequent purge movie sort of addresses a plot hole. Like Purge 2, Anarchy, is like, that doesn't make any sense. Everybody can't go out and purge somebody every year. There wouldn't be anybody left, right? So they get into like, well, actually, purging isn't really economically or practically accessible for everybody. Most people just stay home, lock their doors, and don't participate. So all the purgers, good, bad, or indifferent, are actually like a minority. And then we get this one, election year, kind of hinges into how the people in power like the purge because they can sneak out and do shady things. And like it's a chance to rub someone out with no great conspiracy theory about it. And then there is a latter-day installment that's even newer than election year. It's called The First Purge. And it's about, like, how did this obviously dumb idea get through the filter anyway? And then there's also a Purge TV show, which unfortunately we couldn't screen and didn't know a lot about. But so it's interesting to me just in that each one kind of deepens and they get better and more solid. And the world makes more sense, not less, instead of the normal horror continuity where it just turns into more and more of a mess every time they bring back the killer.
Well, I'm going to hit us with the formal synopsis here. Now, as we discussed the annual purge as established in these films, we said this before, a night of the year when all crime, including murder, is legal. And the propaganda machine in kayfabe would have us believe that all of the hate, all of the divisiveness that is built up in us is quelled on this one night for the rest of the year. So when the public gets a shot to blow off some steam for one night, then they behave themselves the other 364 days. What we find out over the course of the films, and keep in mind what we're talking about is the third installment. So up to this point, The Purge is the symptom of a super stratified public. And The Purge is more or less a sub rosa attempt at keeping the poor populations in check and in control and within reasonable numbers. So The Purge election year, this third film in the franchise, it takes place, I think it was about 14 or 17 years following the events of Purge Anarchy. In the story, the practice of the annual purge is starting to come into criticism, a little bit of question. And as politicians begin running full campaigns on the demise of the purge, during the annual purge of that election year, the new founding fathers, who are the controlling element of this government, remove the exemption from political figures, which allows for political assassination and other machinations to happen more baldly during the purge. As the annual event begins, a staunch anti-purge candidate, played by Elizabeth Mitchell, finds herself under siege as hitmen working for the incumbent have designs on her death. It's up to an elite bodyguard, played by Frank Grillo.
Movie is positive for Frank Grillo.
Oh, I didn't know. I didn't know you were a Grillo file.
But anyways, it's up to Grillo to keep the anti-purge candidate safe through the night that so she can go on to win the election. In the meantime, as they're trapped outside, the senator and the bodyguard team up with a shop owner, his clerk, a nurse, and an ambulance driver who help them survive the night, assist the revolution, and bring an end to the purge once and for all.
Played a lot of purge games this evening. We have just one more. It's called Mommy's Choice. Which one of you will survive this year's purge?
The soul of our country is at stake. The purge targets the poor and the innocent.
The senator's going to win, and she's going to make real changes, too.
It is a night that is defining our country.
It's time to do something about that senator.
The purge has to come to an end.
You take a lot of risks, Senator.
I have to. I was the only one in my family to survive. What made you apply for this position?
I almost did something on purge night some years back. I want this night gone.
I want men in all these rooms. We got eyes and ears on everything.
All right, let's begin.
This is your emergency broadcast system announcing the commencement of the annual purge. At the siren, all crime, including murder, will be legal for 12 hours. Your government thanks you for your participation.
Someone betrayed us. This is not a drill.
Senator, come with us.
You gentlemen understand what's at stake here.
Maybe it's our duty to help protect her.
Here they come.
Blessed be America for letting us purge and cleanse our souls. Join me as we eliminate evil.
Purge and cure madness. Purge and cure
madness. Just remember all the good the purge does.
So, Matt, overall, how do you feel about the property? If we're talking about the purge movies in toto,
it's gone from something that was just a kind of a watch on the tier of like, kind of an exploitative special. Like it went from a solid action movie and now it's built up to a very, very openly political, very very interesting idea. At this point, I'm kind of waiting for the next one. Like, I really do want to see where they end up dragging it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's grown on me over time, which I can't think of any other. And the only, and don't throw anything at me. One of the only other franchises I can think of that
I know where you're going with this, and I agree,
is another cheap horror franchise, which is Paranormal Activity.
Oh, okay. No, I didn't know where you were going with that.
Yeah, the Paranormal Activity movies slowly address their own flaws. Although I have to say, you know, if that's your type of thing, and if number one is not your type of thing, then the last one won't be either.
Mm-hmm.
But it's considerably more of a movie than the first one. Where did you think I was going?
You know, I've got to give the assist here. Friend of the podcast, Scott Joshua Pepper, made this comparison, and I think it's apt. It doesn't fit the cookie cutter perfectly, but I think this is going to work, and I thought this is where you were going. Scott describes the Purge franchise as the Fast and the Furious of political horror films. And to a certain degree, I agree with that.
That is fair.
Because the Fast and the Furious franchise, it's a franchise that I absolutely disliked when it started. And then it really started growing on me over time as it matured and became its own thing. However, where I think the world of Fast and the Furious becomes a little more elastic, a little more plastic, the physics are a little less real, and it becomes bigger and more bombastic, The Purge actually goes the other direction, to where, you know, the first The Purge was, as you said, more of a home invasion film than anything. But on this rewatch of Election Year, I actually watched the first three right in the binge. And when I first sat down to watch The Purge, what I was sold on, Matt, is that Twilight Zone elevator pitch that you were telling me about. It's like, okay, here's the pitch, buy into the conceit, here's how it can go wrong. And what I didn't get ever out of the Purge franchise was a movie about that pitch. Because the Purge has always been kind of political. The story arc that's happening with Ethan Hawke in the first movie is talking about the stratification of society. It's talking about what happens when the haves help out one of the have-nots, and then the other halves take exception to that. There is political allegory there, albeit more veiled. As the movies have gone on, that veil has come down significantly, to the point where it's barely allegory anymore, that these movies are getting very political and that they have a point of view, to the point where I think the first Purge actually used some extant campaign imagery from the current real-world political sphere to sell that movie. And I'm not going to get, you know, that's not the conversation I want to have. We don't need to get into the minutiae of what's currently going on in our political sphere. This movie is making no bones about it. To see it mature as less of a couched political horror movie and into a full-out, this is our protest art, has been really interesting and really captivating. And because on this rewatch, I kind of knew to look for that, and I wasn't looking for the horror film, this rewatch has treated me a lot better. And I can actually say, Matt, I've turned around on these. I'm a fan.
Well, and you also have, I think The Purge is very interesting. And I don't know the background of the people that wrote it. Like, we didn't do that homework. Purge is really interesting to me because it has a super diverse cast as it moves forward from Ethan Hawke, obviously the exception to what I just said, right? We're introduced to some really strange takes on what happens during the Purge. Like the one of the protagonists of Election Year is an EMT driver that her and her partner go out anyway during the Purge.
Mm-hmm.
So they go out in a fortified ambulance, and they work on people anyway. If they can do so safely, they yank them in the back of the ambulance to try to patch them up. And their ambulance has, you know, like expanded metal all around it, and it's a fortress on wheels, and they try to patch up and save who they can. And then another person we follow is a small business owner who's African-American, and he's a older conservative African-American, which is not a character that we get a lot of in horror movies or in genre movies. And that's a real guy. That's a guy that exists, is a 45-year-old guy that owns a gas station. And he is ill-served by all the political actors around him. Now, there's a really interesting thing I picked up this time is, like, when the characters kind of clash in this. So you have Frank Grillo, who is the bodyguard of the anti-purge senator. You know, they send people after them, and they end up taking shelter in this guy's store. Well, Frank Grillo kind of takes over, and the guy says, "Hey, I just saved your life. This is my private property." A little, like in the words of John Travolta, "A please would be nice."
Right.
Yeah, you know, there's a real streak of, like, I saw it this time where I never really picked up on it before. Grillo and the senator really represent kind of there's a strong correlation between them and sort of intrusive, I know what's better for you than you do for your neighborhood, kind of that kind of exterior liberalism.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting, and I certainly didn't pick up on that when I watched this in the theater. And then another real interesting, like a side thing here that kind of got me this time is, like, one thing that happens is they show a party of Russian teenagers arriving at the airport, and they're, like, super psyched to purge.
Mm-hmm. Because the purge doesn't happen anywhere else. This is a uniquely American thing in this world.
Yeah, and when they turn up to purge, they interview them in the airport on the news, and then later they turn up during the events of the movie. They're the people that, if you've seen the poster or the cover of this movie, there's a caricature Uncle Sam and a caricature Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, real stylized.
They are the people wearing that, and they have this love-hate relationship with America, and they're like, "I can't wait to kill some fat, dopey, rude Americans."
Hordes of young adults are arriving from Spain, Denmark, South Africa. They're being called murder tourists, as they are here for one reason: to purge.
We're here to experience the purge, to kill, release all the anger and hate, be like Americans. We're very excited. It's going to be nice to be Afrikaners to do. Now, it's come for you.
Foreigners coming to our capital to kill. Murder tourism. It's the new booming business in our country this year.
And it's this weird kind of, like, oh, they really are in, like, a weird locked in orbit with us, because, like, all of our, you know, our pop culture affects theirs so heavily.
Mm-hmm.
And so the weird, like, here are these people that they're here to kill Americans, but they're also obsessed with American ritual and imagery.
And are participating in a uniquely American, at least for this world, a uniquely American event.
Yeah, it was very, it was a nice little touch. Little, wow, really makes you think there, huh?
Well, and I think there are little aspects of that I don't know if it's effective world building or if it's just something where it captivates the imagination enough that you think about it a little bit after the movie. But there's little touches of that throughout the franchise. And so one of the major things in the first film, Ethan Hawke is our main protagonist, and he's trying to protect his family from a group of purgers outside his multi-million-dollar mansion, which he has secured through a security system that he has sold not only to himself, but other people in the neighborhood. And the fact of the matter is that the security system isn't actually that secure and can actually be dealt with by somebody who's determined enough with just a little bit of effort. And there's this question about him profiteering off the purge to sell fake security to the other well-to-dos in the neighborhood. And there's a question of culpability. There's a question of responsibility. And so that's throughout this franchise.
That shows up again in election year, because the Joe, the shop owner, they call him and squeeze him for more money for his purge insurance right before the day, you know.
Mm-hmm. And so it's just little interesting touches like that. And the reason I bring it up is because I think the purge tourism angle was really interesting. And to kind of consider, it's like, oh, yeah, what would happen if? And the Purge franchise leaves a lot of those questions unanswered. And as you said, the more films that come out, the more questions they do try to address. But there are questions about, like, you know, what does a last will and testament look like in the world of the Purge? Can you write in a clause where your kid doesn't get your money if he offs you during the Purge? Is that a thing?
There's a character in Election Year. When she shows up on scene, she's already all bloody. And she's had a previous run-in with our protagonists, not during the Purge. And they called her out for some bad behavior. And she's made a point of coming back to deal with them. And she says, basically, it's sort of a Menendez brothers kind of thing. She mentions that her and her sister have, quote-unquote, taken care of their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And so you do ask yourself, like, well, did they get the house after that?
Right.
I mean, and there's also, like, if you think about the logistics of the Purge too hard, your head will start to explode. Because how does it work? Do they just, like, if a homicide has a time of death during the Purge, do they just not investigate it? Because, like, how do you, what if I set a bomb during the week, but then hit the button during the Purge?
Right.
You can find these corner cases that will ruin your suspension of disbelief.
And, like, to a certain degree, they kind of try and address it by putting it out there. In the second film, Frank Grillo is reprising a role here that was established in the second Purge. Now, he looks incredible for aging almost 20 years between films. In the second Purge, he
I'm Italian. I'm Italian. I work out. I can play 25 to 55.
But he has a mission in the second Purge where there is a particular person that he wants to dole out some justice to. And isn't given the opportunity until the very tail end of the Purge as the sun is coming up. And he talks about that earlier this week he went to the house and disabled the security system. And so there is that question of, well, if that was destruction of property before the Purge, and that's a crime that allowed him to more effectively purge during the Purge, is that a thing? Now, they never actually say yes or no. But they do say, yeah, this kind of happens sometimes.
Say he kills the guy. Does the state go around bringing, like just sort of prima facie charges against people that do things like that?
Right.
Or, like, what if I take money to kill someone during the Purge? Is that enforceable?
Yeah, and if the money changes hands before or after the Purge, does that count?
Or if it changes hands on Purge Day? Then it should theoretically all be good. But then what if I don't kill him? Can the guy sue me for the money back? What if I try to kill my boss and I don't get her done?
And
I have to go to work on Monday morning. Am I insulated from the consequences of my attempted purge? Or is it like, free speech?
And ultimately, where this is all leading is you as the viewer are going to arrive at this can't possibly work. And what we have learned over the course of three movies is that, no, it doesn't. It's not a perfect system. It is a system full of flaws and inherent with flaws. And even though it is deeply flawed, they still do it. And that's kind of the point where the grander franchise has been driving. Now, whether that was lucky storytelling after the fact or always an intended direction for this, we'd have to buy the guy a beer, but I like where it's going.
That's another chunk of my thesis that these are getting better over time is because one thing we see is that as the movies go on, they dwell more on the political party that has done this, which is called the New Founding Fathers.
Mm-hmm.
And this episode, the head of the New Founding Fathers is played by it's the man that played Arlo Givens on Justified.
Yeah. I got this time too.
Who Raymond Barry is the guy's name, who is also, oh, by the way, the guy that plays Joe is the guy that plays Limehouse.
Oh, no kidding.
So there's two Justified alums in there. Raymond Barry from Justified, who is he looks suspiciously like Jeff Sessions in this. I'm just gonna come out and say it.
Right? I thought the same thing too.
and he is the head of the party. And then we have the president, and the president is a member of that party. He's not terribly developed. He's actually just kind of a stuffed shirt in this. But what I think is really interesting is the more they dwell, by the end of it, by the end of this third one, the NFA have turned into almost like a they're a culty thing, because like on their purge night, they actually do like, it's almost a like an evangelical ritual where they purge people, and the donors get the first purge, and then the party leaders, and then finally the president's going to purge. And it's this almost tent revival atmosphere. And at one point the president actually starts speaking in tongues. I think giving them more personification as the series goes on, making them a villain more like, or a clan of villains more like the Fireflies or the Sawyers it's helped the series. And they're so like, by the time when they line up to purge this one, they give the first purge to this mega donor, and he is just this ghoul. He's just a very, very creepy looking dude. And, they're all sitting there, and they have, so they're all these guys in like bad suits. The women have the big Tammy Faye Baker outdated hair. And, when they finally, the final action piece starts, like they all take out their sidearm, you know, they're ready to purge. It's a very creepy face put on the opposition. And I think that helped, because in the first couple is really just, in the first one in particular, it was just randos out on the street. And then it slowly became like, well,
the first one, you are definitely led to believe that there is the purgers who are outside the front door are very affluent. And that is a thread that runs throughout these movies, is that there is a feeling of privilege on behalf of the moneyed people in these movies, that they say that the purge is their right as granted by the new founding fathers. It's one of those rights that they take, but it's also it's saying something, because nobody says anything about the rights of the guy who has a right to run the hell away, or the rights of the people to harbor a fugitive that has been running away, you know?
And then in like the second one, we see like the first politician, who is a guy that he actually has, like, he has a whole semi-truck customized for him to purge out of.
Mm-hmm.
So he just rolls into a bad neighborhood, opens up the back, and opens up with a minigun. We see the first kind of big game hunter that we're introduced to, and that's the sort of antagonist of number two.
Well, and he's also doing it for the government in that movie. He's the government. That's when we start learning that the government is actually using the purge to literally purge some of the people who are homeless, who are jobless, who are weighing down on the economic numbers that the U.S. Uses to benchmark success, in an eerie kind of almost Twilight Zone version of what we saw in, I'm going to bring it up again, Pump Up the Volume, where the school was expelling or suspending students who had low test scores. In this movie, we're literally dragging the poor people with no jobs out into the street to bring our employment numbers up. Guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich. That's how it goes.
Everybody knows. What are you watching?
Hey, what are you reading?
Tell me, what are you loving this week?
What are you putting in your ears?
Welcome to The Box. I'm Charity.
I'm Crystal.
I'm Rebecca. On The Box, we talk about all the media we love, old and new.
Here are hottest takes on the classic movies, new TV shows, our favorite podcasts, and what we downloaded this week.
Subscribe on iTunes at HSPN The Box or wherever you get your podcasts to hear us every week.
And don't forget, too much TV will rot your brain.
A proud member of the Hello Sweetie Podcast Network.
Everybody knows.
That's how it goes.
And everybody knows.
As we move on, we see kind of a now this one, they're specifically going after a credible political threat. So there is a woman who might win the presidency away from the president, and they want her rubbed out. And that's why there are a few rules to the purge about, I think they're like about WMDs Like they go by pretty fast whenever they flash them.
And they're not particularly dwelt on, yeah.
Yeah, there's a few things you can't do, and one of them is attack government officials over "quote unquote" level 10,
mm-hmm.
which I guess from this movie we can infer that that's at least Congress and up. So they lift the restriction essentially specifically to have a go at this woman. Now, what's interesting about that is, given that they have a bunch of purging rituals, it's not a reciprocal rule. It's not that people of over a certain rank don't participate.
No.
It's that if they're over a certain rank, the ban on killing them doesn't apply to them.
Right.
So they can purge, but you can't purge them. And that's a subtlety that's never lampshaded. Like they don't talk about the fact that it's enshrined in the code that the very 1% is immune with all the benefits.
Well, you look at the scene at the climax of Anarchy of Part 2, where they drop a bunch of captives into what looks like a really high-class paintball field, and people bid on the opportunity to purge in these environments. And nobody is batting an eye when the rich people are killing the poor people. However, when Frank Grillo gets dropped in there, manages to wrestle a gun away, and starts killing the other people, it is a huge tragedy. And people are upset and they're crying, and it all of a sudden, because it's one of their own, there's a human element to it.
It's another one of those things where like the legality of the purge is sort of odd, because if you aren't subject to the purge, but you're attacking me, can I still defend myself? Certainly there couldn't be a state where during the purge I have less rights. But that's, again, you can't think about it too hard or your head go pop.
Well, I'll tell you what, we talked about this a little bit. As these movies go on, they just get more naked with their politics. And I'm willing to bet that we probably have a few people out there in the audience who either don't agree with our politics or don't agree with the politics of this particular movie or any of the other movies. You know, we try not to get political on the show, but we don't make it a point to shy away from it either when it comes up. We've obviously gotten political with episodes like Network or Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, where, you know, Matt and I aren't afraid to get our toe in there.
I have to say this about that, and this is sort of, again, not to get into politics, but this is sort of the thesis of my politics lately is, like, I think these are American narratives. You know, a middle-aged black man that worked his whole life to buy and build a deli, and he sits on the roof during a riot and defends it with his weapons that he owns. Is that like a liberal canard? Surely not. If you find that to be liberal propaganda, there can only be one reason why. You know? Likewise, the idea of these first responders that go to work for no pay because somebody's got to damn well do it, that is a beautiful American narrative to me. Like, I don't find that to be a politicized narrative.
No, that's not that also is not a liberal canard, you know.
In a time when we're not really looking for common ground, there's plenty of it implied here, you know.
But when a movie or a piece of artwork or even a podcast, and Matt, I'm asking you specifically, when these things become naked, when the politics are laid to bear, when we have those moments where we kind of unzip our hoodies a little bit and show you what color is underneath, is that a problem? Is that a problem when you're getting naked with your politics, when you're trying to reach the broadest audience possible? And maybe the Purge knows its audience and it knows what it's going for, but obviously. But do you think that's a problem when mainstream art gets political?
That's a hard one. I think it's probably not the best policy in quote-unquote mainstream art. Now, for the podcasting world, I have to say, part of what makes podcasting is that it's happening without that input. And so some people's cachet in podcasting is that they're exactly who they say they are. And they're more subscribers to that. I forget the name of the productivity author, but there's a guy that talks about having 1,000 true fans, that if you have 1,000 people that buy $50 worth of product from you a year, you have an income, and that's better than 100,000 people that just like you and buy nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I think maybe part of what makes podcasting is authenticity. So I think you should do you, but I also think like this isn't a political podcast.
Right.
And there's also like there's plenty of that out there if you want it, and you don't necessarily like if you're on side A, you don't need any more you don't need a louder echo chamber. And if you're on side B, why ruin it? And,
yeah,
and people need some spaces that are away from the dialectic, or you just end up turning off the television, reading old Goosebumps.
I put this down to talk about because I think it's an interesting analog. When the movie Jun Ho Bong's film Snowpiercer came out, Snowpiercer is allegorical. I mean, you don't have to read a political message into it, but you certainly can. There was even a situation, Matt, where you and I were talking about the film on social media, and we had some friends who disagreed with the perceived politics in Snowpiercer. And so, like, we watched it and we're like, yeah, let's go with this movie. This is a good film. And when people don't hear a political message they agree with, it kind of takes them out. And so do you think, and really the big question I'm driving at, is there a responsibility by Hollywood as an industry or by a particular filmmaker to present a neutral party or a neutral side or to look at it more objectively?
Like in fiction? No, there's no obligation to neutrality. It's the opposite. Like if anything, there's an obligation to point of view, which is a different topic than neutrality in documentation. Like if you're presenting yourself as neutral, you need to be neutral.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if anything, like you can make tremendous art about biased politics. You know, Norma Rae, Reds, Metropolis, one of the very first science fiction movies of any standing. Very political films. Actually, it's really weird. I had a conversation today with someone that said they weren't a huge fan of Beetlejuice because they didn't like that Beetlejuice was so jocular about personal space and sort of Beetlejuice is pretty intense about like touching people without consent.
Mm-hmm.
He's not the nice. And someone else pointed out that, well, Beetlejuice isn't the protagonist. Like Beetlejuice is not good.
He's not the aspirational character.
Well, he's not only not the aspirational character, he's ultimately the villain.
Yeah.
And the original speaker was like, well, he's still presented as being so fun in the first half of it that I think it enables things. And like, I felt like I had to point out like, well,
that's what happens.
Valid, like
yeah,
fair. Nobody's take is bad. That's the point. Like for one thing, he's a temptress. Like, well, not a temptress, but he's a demonic character. The point of him is like he shows up at first, and he's the Cat in the Hat. He makes sin fun, and then it gets serious.
Mm-hmm.
The other point is, I sit here in Southern Utah, where Ted Bundy, you know, charmed and killed a number of people. And so it's a fair point that if you were to make all fiction, you know, every villain has to be a mustache twirler. He's not allowed to commit assault or be mean until he's clearly the villain.
Mm-hmm.
Then our fiction and part of this goes back to if you think consequence flows from fiction in the first place, right?
Right.
But if fiction is consequential, then it has a paradoxical duty to be realistic. And so if you believe that behavior depicted in fiction is enabling in reality, which is a different conversation, but if you grant that, then you have to also go, well, then they have to, at some point, somebody's fiction has to point out that you can be lied to, like a charming miscreant exists.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real type.
It becomes a lie if they don't acknowledge it. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not obligated to never use it in fiction. Now, if it's every time, you know, if it's every movie, if it's every villain, if it's every little pat on the ass is forgiven, then you lose that shield eventually, mm-hmm. right? I don't know. I thought it was really interesting because, and the reason I'm kind of bringing it up and dwelling on it, the reason it's germane to The Purge is The Purge is very exploitative. Like, there's a lot of violence here, and there's a lot of, nobody's naked, but there's definitely some objectification here. There's some
sexuality.
There's some kind of almost blaxploitation here. There's some guys that are, I mean, you could consider them stereotypical characters, although they're people I've met.
Yeah.
You know, they're just like a guy in a red MAGA hat with an open carrying a sidearm is a stereotype and a real guy. An older black business owner who's not all that politically correct himself is a real guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exploitation cinema that's made by people that don't actually agree with the exploitation is always kind of like that. It's like, well, or like comedy where you're quote unquote playing a character, you know, exploitation films are the Andrew Dice Clay of genre cinema.
Well, and I guess that was going to be a question I had for us to talk about is the films thematically have a very anti-violent stance. Like, the arc and redemption of several characters is that when given the chance to purge, they do not. But for a movie that seems to be preaching nonviolence as a virtue, these are really violent films. Like, we see some definite heads exploding on camera. And so that is a weird line. And you're right. It does. This is not a new thing. Exploitation film is full of stuff like this.
Yeah, I think we've talked before about the worst exploitation films we've ever been exposed to were those ones that were produced by the Papa Doc regime. Like, what were they? Mondo Carne and My Life as a Dog, and those were ostensibly about slavery, but they had recreations that were so detailed and filmed with real people of color who were actually impoverished and were actually put through very degrading acts making the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because their brutal dictator, because they were fascinated by Hollywood, he wanted to make a movie. And so this whole thing spirals out of control. It's one of those ones where you only go to a charity screening of it because you don't want the people that made it. I think they've actually disavowed profiting from it. But they did things like they dressed the people up as actual slaves and actually pulled their teeth and did really, really sick stuff to these extras in these films.
Yeah.
Of course, there was Cannibal Holocaust and the Guinea Pig series out of Japan. The content in them was so strong. Law enforcement actually went to the producers and said, can you put us in contact with these actors? We want to demonstrate your special effects, because they were concerned that they were actual snuff films.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the problem is, like, intrinsically, most genre film is not realistic. Like nobody who's ever seen, like, a real murder on the news is under the illusion, or in real life. I don't know what trauma our listeners have, but nobody that's ever seen real violence has any illusion. Like, if you've seen a guy beat up in public, it doesn't look like a Bruce Lee movie. You know, if you've seen a shooting, it doesn't look like a Rambo movie. And we talked about this when we talked about the guys in Africa making the action movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, director Isaac and Wakili Wood.
Yeah, they're having fun. They're having fun with tropes. They know. And I think that was being done in the 80s as well, when some of, like, our favorite crazy action movies came out. Like, that was a high crime time.
Mm-hmm.
And people wanted a goofy distraction with a lot of melodrama in it. They didn't, like, nobody out there on, like, the mean streets of the terrible neighborhoods of America, they weren't sitting out there going, that commando with Schwarzenegger, that's not realistic. You know, they were just like, that was kick ass. That's why this series wraps me in circles, because they are kind of trading on a grit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's a darkness to these that is definitely more, and that's where that label exploitation comes from, is because it's a movie that's trying to trade on the real thing a little bit.
Well, Matt, ultimately, with this film specifically, but maybe even the Purge series in general, what do you think they're trying to convey? Obviously, they have some bald politics here. Obviously, they have a point of view. But really, what do you think the filmmakers are trying to leave audiences with as they walk out the door?
I'll put it this way. I'm glad they made up a fictional party. because I like the message in this about how these neighborhood people come together and look after each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the message in this about trusting the old Mark One eyeball over gossip. I like the message in here about nonconformity and what happens with the little guy over the course of the Purge is pretty fascinating. It showcases a lot of regular people being regular and also standing up for themselves, which I think I shouldn't even say standing up for ourselves. We stand up for ourselves plenty. We don't stand up for our neighbor very much right now.
Yeah, for sure.
How the hell did it get to this?
Who's he? Why is he cuffed?
Rondo. 2 bullet holes delivered by a rival gang. But he's a good kid. He's chained up because I didn't want him purging anymore. So, Senator, NFFA made a move on your ass.
Seems that way.
Goddamn conniving, duplicitous, crooked politicians.
Agreed. We're not all that bad.
My experience, Senator, my people are on their own, no matter what y'all say or promise.
I'm kind of confused here. Who the hell is this lady?
You big dope. You give people from the neighborhood a bad name.
And that empathy gap, I think, is the problem.
Well, and that even begins in the first film, and that's a good segue, because I want to throw out a shout-out to this actor. But there is one actor who appears in all of the first three, and I'm not sure if he appears in the prequel or not. Like I said, I haven't seen it, so I'm not sure. But Edwin Hodge, his only character name in the first film is Bloody Stranger. And he shows up as a stranger who takes refuge inside Ethan Hawke's home. And there's some question. Ethan Hawke has to decide if he is going to defend this random stranger of different race, of different social status. Is he going to protect this person from the people outside? Because if he does, the people outside are going to want to come inside and purge on them as well. And so there's a real ethical dilemma there. And you then get to follow this character, played by Edwin Hodge, through the other two movies. In the second one, he shows up as an assistant to kind of this uprising against the Purge, this grassroots, somewhat militant group that is fighting against the Purge and fighting against the government, who by the time we've gotten to the third movie, is almost a full guerrilla kind of extremist group against the Purge. And even though they are on the side of our protagonists and of our senator here, their extreme form of political involvement is something that the senator can't co-sign on. And in the third Purge, the Edwin Hodge character is the leader of this movement, or is among the leaders of this movement. And so seeing him go from, random bloody stranger who was basically the victim of a fox hunt by a bunch of wealthy purgers to the leader of this movement somewhat 17, 18 years later was very rewarding. And I really enjoyed that. As far as thematically goes, I'm with you, Matt. I think it's more a matter of us banding together as people and us taking care of each other. It is one thing to engage, and it's one thing to engage politically, but we all have to remember that we're all in this together. Even the people we disagree with are still in the boat with us.
And we know who the real... we also know who the real enemy is.
Oh, yeah? Who's that?
It's the White Walkers. You may have heard of them. Speaking of something you can project a lot of political allegory on... I don't know. You're not that Game of Thrones-y, are you?
No, and it's not like I'm not avoiding Game of Thrones. I never did get into it.
The whole point of Game of Thrones is that they're doing so much internecine warfare that they're not ready for an international threat. Basically, they have something external show up and they have to stop fighting and fight it.
All right, Matt. Well, final thoughts. Ari, the Purge election year.
The Purge has some strong content. It is pretty violent. It's a hard R for violence. although not a lot of nudity or anything like that.
You know, that is something I always... I don't know that puzzling is the right word, but it's definitely an unplumbed aspect of this. And I don't know that we necessarily need to go there because of the story they're telling, because of the political allegory here. But it seems to me that the Purge night would also be a big night for bacchanals and indiscriminate sex. You know, there are other laws that don't involve hurting or maiming people that could potentially be broken that night.
There's a little bit more of that covered in the first Purge, but they don't, but still not very graphic. Like they just seem to have made some sort of decision to, maybe they're looking for kind of a soft R that the teenagers can still get away with going to. I don't know.
Well, and honest to God, it's just, it's not part of the narrative. It's not part of the thematic narrative that people are telling. It would, you know, and that's where the fact that they didn't get into that shows to me that they were willing to stay their hand a little bit to convey what they needed to convey, to tell the story they wanted to tell. And even though they are being exploitational with it, they're not going the full Monty. They're not pulling a full Human Centipede Part 2. They're willing to hold their hand to make sure that their message gets across.
Yeah, I don't know. They're kind of, I find them kind of punk rock. Like, they're fun without being too comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And they're messaged without being too preachy. They don't really stop and yell it at you. I like that. And I, like I said, I think they get better over time. I'm really curious about the TV series.
Yeah, I have the first Purge in the TV series on deck in the weeks to come. So maybe we can loop back on this and see how we're doing.
Hey, that brings us to that segment, doesn't it?
It sure does, Matt.
I really liked, in this vein, if you just like the anarchy without the politics... well, with a little politics, I guess, but they're outdated politics. The escape movies, Escape from New York and Escape from L.A. And also, I guess along those lines, there's some other quality 80s dystopia. There's The Running Man.
As far as a recommendation for me, I already kind of blew it, but I actually went Snowpiercer on this. It's another movie. It's action-packed. It's got some good action in it. No Frank Grillo, but we've got Chris Evans, Captain America. And it's another movie that's got some strong political allegory. And you don't have to enjoy the political narrative to get it, but it's certainly there. It's there to be picked if one wants to.
What I thought was really strange about the alleged politics of Snowpiercer... is, and I know Snowpiercer is based on a graphic novel, isn't it?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So maybe it's heavier in the graphic novel. I suppose there's some class politics and some, like, but some revolutionary politics in there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's about a giant perpetually running train, and the people that live in the tail are the underclass to the upper class in the front. We follow like a kind of class revolution. But the theming isn't all that, like, it's not really the giant, like I think it was sort of thought to be, like, kind of anti-objectivist, like an antithetical to an Ayn Rand.
Mm-hmm.
But it really wasn't, like, that heavy-handed to me. I think a lot of the people that were mad about it were mad about the thing they read about it.
That might be. But, you know, you also have to contextualize the time that this came out. There was still a lot of... We had kind of ebbed and flowed away from Occupy Wall Street, but it was still very much at the forefront of people's minds. And there is definitely a giant middle finger to the upper class in that movie. And at the time, a giant middle finger to the upper class or to the 1% was perceived as a giant middle finger to certain political affiliations. And I'm not sure that that's not entirely true now. And so I think... It all depends on who you identify with in the movie. And ultimately, that's a subjective take. Like, we can't argue that.
Well, what are you supposed to tell somebody that identifies with the people at the front of the train? I mean, if that's like a legit subjective, that, like, well, yeah, some people just identify. Look, I'm really more of a team sheriff of Nottingham kind of guy, you know? He was Law and Order. I mean, there are limits to equivalency. Oh, and I'll come back to my final one. There's a documentary series on Netflix called Fight World. and it is hosted by Frank Grillo. If you're into his action scenes and you want to see more about his, because he does one of his own stunts he's permitted to do, and he is a real life martial arts enthusiast. And so if you want more Grillo in your life, it's a pretty good little travel thing. Looking at the martial arts of the world reminds me of Dahani Tackles the Globe with Dahani Jones,
mm-hmm.
a series where they took an NFL athlete and they put him in different sports. So he would go, they would take him to whatever country and plop him into the sport of record there. And about half of them were various martial arts or wrestlings. And so it was very interesting to see how quick, like, a talented person can adapt to a new sport. And this is kind of similar because Grillo takes you, like, all around the world. And, like, it's pretty fascinating how, like, in-depth, like, some countries, they start, like, their fight culture and their sports culture. They start, like, oh, I guess we have peewee football where you take some knocks. But, like, they start boxers and kickboxers, like, in Mexico and Thailand and stuff. They start them so young. Like, that's always a shocker for me when it's like 2 9-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just it's a nice kind of Bourdain type piece, RIP. He just goes somewhere with a theme and lives the life, eats the food, gets the t-shirts.
You know, my final recommendation here is going to fare on the end of more of the action that's present in these films and less on the cerebral end. But it's a film that I don't think it's enough love, and really the reason I bring it up is because The Purge, I fell victim to this franchise, to something we've talked about on the show before, which is the movie that was happening in my head is not what I got on screen, and that's what I think led to that initial disappointment in the series for me. And the movie that I had in my head was going to be an Irwin Allen movie, where we have the team of nice people that we relate to, who are stuck outside after the Purge horn blows, and they're just trying to make it through the night. And I think to a certain degree, number two is kind of the closest we got to that movie. But if you do want to see an action star taking a group of people through a situation where all hell is broken loose and you've just burned out your copy of the Poseidon Adventure, I'm going to recommend that you watch the Sylvester Stallone vehicle Daylight, which is about an accident in the Holland Tunnel that leaves it sealed off at both ends, and it's up to Sylvester Stallone to get a group of survivors out of the tunnels, as he is a pseudo-expert who ran hypothetical situations along these lines back in his previous life. And so if that's the aspect of The Purge that you enjoy, it is the Frank Grillo is the skilled individual taking a group of untrained normal civvies through this hellscape, you can get a lot of that in movies like that, and Daylight's going to be the one I recommend for this.
Oh, can I tack one more on real quick?
I suppose.
If you are a fan of The Purge 1 because you like the siege element, if you're into siege and home invasion type stuff, I always recommend, because I think it's very technically novel, there's a movie called Kidnapped in the U.S. Its Spanish title is Secuestrados. Very basic kidnapping home invasion movie, but it has the conceit of like Hitchcock's Rope, where it has 12 cuts in it.
Hmm.
So it's a movie composed of very long shots, and I always think that's always a fun thing. it is rather graphic. Not nice people do not nice things. I think it's unrated in the U.S., so fair warning, it should be an R.
All right, Matt. Well, I think that's about going to wrap it up for me. Anything else from you?
Oh, no, I'm GTG, brah.
All right. Well, that's going to wrap it up for this particular edition of the Nighthawks Podcast, a proud member of the Hello Sweetie Podcast Network family of podcasts. Be sure to track us down. We're online, nighthawkspodcast.com. You can also find us on Facebook, Nighthawks Podcast, and find us on the Twitter, at Nighthawks Pod. We also have presences, most importantly, on most podcast aggregates. We're talking about iTunes, we're talking about Spotify, we're talking about Stitcher. Be sure to find us there, and when you do, you would be doing us just a big old favor if That podcast aggregate that you use gives the option for a review or a rating, like it does on iTunes, for example, especially if it's on iTunes. Give us a shout, because that is good business for us. In that vein, if you like what you're hearing, word of mouth is always good, too. Just tell your friends about us.
Make one person listen to an episode.
Get them in a long car trip and just pop it on and say, here, enjoy.
Yeah, yeah. Convert people. Convert people to our cult and our message.
May not actually be a cult.
Maybe a cult in the future.
All right, Matt. Well, I think that's about going to wrap it up for us. We're going to sign off because it's almost morning.
Bye, my pirate cripplers.
Now, you citizens of Boston, don't you think it's a scandal how the people have to pay and pay? Fight the fare increase, vote for George O'Brien, get for Charlie off the MTA. Or else he'll never return, no, he'll never return, and his fate is still unlearned.
Just like Molly,
he may ride forever beneath the streets of Boston. He's the man who'll never return. He's the man who'll never return. He's the man who'll never return. Hey, to Charlie.